Pope Francis finished his trip to the Middle East this week. Will he bring peace? And will President Trump bring war to Venezuela? And what is going on with Asia's new bromance? We're going to find out on today's Trumpet World. Last week, we kicked off by talking about Pope Francis's trip to Turkey, focusing mostly on his rather dramatic views on church unity and on the Council of Nicaea. Well, now he's been off to Lebanon, and we've gotten a good look at some of his views on Middle East politics. So for more on this, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, as you mentioned, this was a part two, you could say, of his visit to Turkey. He had a three-day visit in Beirut from Sunday to Tuesday. Lebanon is not a Catholic majority country, but there are still well over a million people there that belong to one of the Catholic Church's Eastern Catholic branches. So Lebanon, you could say, is the first traditionally Catholic land Pope Leo has visited. By comparison, the last papal visit Lebanon has had was by Pope Benedict in 2012. That's 7 years after he became Pope, and Pope Francis never visited the country, so that Leo picked Lebanon as part of his first overseas trip shows just how important he thinks his relationship with the Lebanese Catholicism's influence in Lebanon is. On Monday, he had an address in English to the government, both the president, who is a Catholic, and the prime minister, who is a Sunni Muslim, were attending. He announced that the theme of his trip was based off of Matthew 5, verse 9, "Blessed are the peacemakers." He used that word peace over 20 times in his address. So you could see that with all the turmoil Lebanon has had with Hezbollah, with the brief war with Israel, this is definitely on his mind to try and at least bring some comfort and hope and perhaps even fix problems to the Lebanese. His address was noteworthy for several reasons.
Certainly, there are millions of Lebanese here and throughout the world who serve peace silently day after day. Yet you, who have important institutional tasks within this nation, are destined for a special beatitude if you can say that you have put the goal of peace above all else. At the same time, there can be no lasting reconciliation without a common goal, or without openness towards a future in which good prevails over the evils that have been suffered or inflicted in the past or the present. A culture of reconciliation, therefore, does not arise only from below, from the willingness and courage of a few. It also needs authorities and institutions that recognize the common good as superior to the particular.
That was a segment from his speech where he endorsed the Lebanese government and everything that they're doing. Some context is necessary for there. The new government in Lebanon, they only came to power since last January on a platform of agreeing to the ceasefire deal with Israel on disarming Hezbollah and removing their military influence from the country. And that was originally received quite well by many in Lebanon when they came in. Almost a year later, hardly anything has been done to that. Hezbollah has not disarmed. If anything, they are rapidly regaining their strength. Israel is still striking Hezbollah, and the Lebanese government has been caught in the middle and not really doing anything about it, having some strongly worded statements for both sides, but other than that, staying out of the fray. With that in mind, the Pope's comments, you could say that he is endorsing the government's original plan and encouraging more Lebanese people to get behind it, and perhaps even expressing a little bit of impatience, like saying, you guys said you were going to do this a year ago, it hasn't happened yet, what's going on, we need to start picking up the pace. That's not the only thing the Pope said in his speech that I thought was interesting.
There are times when it is easier to flee or simply more convenient to move elsewhere. It takes real courage and foresight to stay or to return to one's own country and to consider even somewhat difficult situations worthy of love and dedication. We know that here as in other parts of the world, uncertainty, violence, poverty, and many other threats are leading to an exodus of young people and families seeking a future elsewhere, even though it is very painful to leave one's homeland. It is certainly necessary to recognize that much good can come to all of you from having Lebanese people spread throughout the world. However, we must not forget that remaining in our homeland and working day by day to develop a civilization of love and peace remains something very valuable.
Now, even at the very least, this is very, very different optics than what we've seen throughout Pope Francis's pontificate. Francis repeatedly encouraged Western governments to remove barriers, to encourage illegal migration, to accommodate them into their countries. Pope Leo, his first trip abroad, his first trip to the Middle East, and he says not only do people need to stop leaving the Middle East, they need to stay put in a country that is a war zone, but he encouraged people that have already immigrated, that have already moved to Western countries, that have already settled down there, to come back. I think there is some strategy with this. Lebanon's percentage of Christians as part of its population is shrinking. The Muslim populations are increasing. And who do you think is going to take the Pope's call to return most seriously? It's obviously going to be Lebanese Catholics. So perhaps there's even a demographic component into this and encouraging Lebanon's Catholic diaspora to come back. But in any event, still a very, very significant speech from the Pope.
Thanks for those highlights from his trip. I think another important part of this was the big mass that came at the end of his trip with pretty massive turnout, where he had this ceremony at the site of the Beirut blast. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so that was the following day. The Vatican estimates that 150,000 people, give or take, were present for his mass, their massive audience. The Beirut blast, of course, in 2020 was this explosion of ammonium nitrate at the port of Beirut. There's plenty of famous videos on the internet circulating about that. Over 160 people died, hundreds were injured, and in a country like Lebanon, where people live close together in ramshackled housing, hundreds of thousands were left homeless because of that blast. And from what people have been able to gather, Hezbollah was storing ammonium nitrate, it's a military chemical, in that port in very shabby conditions, and there was an accidental blast, but it was still caused by Hezbollah. And because of Hezbollah and its influence, 5 years later, there's been a lot of stonewalling in the Lebanese government's investigation. It hasn't concluded yet, nobody has been brought to justice, and everybody knows it's only because of Hezbollah's stonewalling. So for the Pope to have a mass there with so many people in attendance is certainly a huge deal of problems. Nobody else is talking about these problems. I understand them and I want to do something about them. Right before the mass, he actually met with some of the family members of the victims of the blast and prayed with them, which, again, you think back to Pope Francis's pontificate, not to say he didn't care for those people per se, but throughout his whole 11 years, give or take, of his papacy, he never even visited Lebanon. And Pope Leo, he makes it almost his first priority as pontiff, as traveling overseas, to go to these people and do something like this. So again, it shows he's very concerned, and it does, I think, show a message to Hezbollah.
And he seems like he's getting ready to take a message more directly to Hezbollah. He hinted at this in his traditional press conference on the plane on the way home. What can you tell us about those comments?
Well, they're very brief, but he basically implied that there are indirect talks between the Vatican and Hezbollah for some sort of peace negotiation. He said, our work is not something we announce publicly, so the details are scant. But, I mean, for the Vatican to be negotiating with Hezbollah like this, and at least from what we can tell, it sounds like this is something that Pope Leo initiated. It's not something carrying over from Francis's pontificate. It shows, I think, as a good symbol, a good bellwether of just how more politically minded this Pope is, especially with the Middle East. Pope Francis, he obviously had a lot to say about, again, international migration, about attacking President Donald Trump, whatnot. He was certainly a political pope, but looks like Pope Leo may even be even more of a politically minded pope in getting involved in one of the biggest flashpoints in the world for decades so early.
And talking with Hezbollah wasn't the only thing he announced. He also talked about making a visit to Algeria. He also talked about making a visit to Latin America, something that people were kind of surprised that Pope Francis didn't do more of. But we're seeing Pope Leo, I think, have a definite agenda of reaching out and trying to build ties between the Catholic Church and, I think, Sunni Islam, but even the Catholic Church and Europe and just, you know, any of these places that are available, or that there are opportunities for building ties with, like, Latin America as well. This could be a very significant contribution from him to Europe and the rising power in Europe. And I think this is a prophecy that is being fulfilled. We have written about Europe cultivating this alliance of Sunni Muslims, and you now see Pope Francis playing a major role in making that alliance happen. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about that prophecy.
Yes, that will be in Psalm 83. It seems like that's the prophecy I go to every week on this program all of a sudden, but it refers to an alliance of different Middle Eastern peoples that you look through the Bible, you can look through secular history books, has never existed. And because of that, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that this is a prophecy for our day. Verses 6 through 8 detail which countries would be involved in that. If you'd like to learn more about that, we have a trends article that goes into detail each country and the Middle Eastern nation that it corresponds to today. Specifically, I want to focus on Gebal and Tyre. Those are two ancient Phoenician city-states in the territory of Lebanon that still exist in Lebanon today as cities. Gebal is, or Byblos, as it is also known, is in the north, and Tyre is in the south. And verse 8 mentions Asher, or Assyria, which today is Germany, which is why we predict an alliance between different peoples in the Middle East today. You could say the moderate Arabs, quote-unquote, and Germany, and Europe. There's other prophecies you could tie in that this budding European empire also has a religious component to it as well, that the Catholic Church, the Vatican, will be instrumental in building up Europe into a superpower. It's technically not mentioned in this prophecy, but with the inclusion of Asher, with the inclusion of this European system, we watch for the Catholic Church to have a part in building this alliance as well. And Lebanon has an incredibly important role in that because of its high percentage of Catholics. In 2014, Mr. Fleury wrote an article called Why You Need to Watch Lebanon, where he wrote that Lebanon's, quote, heavily Christian population makes Lebanon different from the rest of the Arab world. Further down, he writes, because of its high population of Christian Arabs, Lebanon has become a linchpin for the Psalm 83 alliance, end quote. And if you see the attention Pope Leo is putting on Lebanon, on the Lebanese, with this his first foreign trip, it looks like, at least to a limited degree, he actually sees Lebanon's linchpin status, Lebanon being a bridge almost between the European world and the Middle East. So this is definitely something we will be keeping an eye on as the Pope makes outreaches to more Muslim countries, as the Pope perhaps even falls through with some of the implications he had with his visit to Lebanon more closely.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. What other stories did you have for us from the Middle East?
Just one. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists published on December 4th what it calls its Damascus dossier. Since Bashar Assad left power in Syria last year, journalists have been poring over documents from his regime, and this is one of the most thorough examinations of that. It published, among other things, thousands upon thousands of photos of dead bodies found in Assad's prisons. A lot of them look like emaciated half skeletons. It's actually quite horrifying. Some of them identified as prominent activists, some only identified by the numbers the security apparatus gave them. But Tied with that, the dossier also reported that the United Nations gave $11 million between 2014 and 2024 to those same security services through the to that intelligence apparatus through a front security company that they were paying for protection for their staff and their offices in Damascus. The UN found out about this, that the money they were giving was actually going to Assad's repression, but they continued to operate there. They continued to send money over to Assad for years. And when questioned about it, they denied any wrongdoing. We've talked about on this program before the corruption of the UN in places like helping Hamas attack Israel and Gaza. It's not only Hamas that the UN is guilty of sponsoring. You can see here that they're even giving millions of dollars to Assad's government.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo, and for that focus on that prophesied alliance that we're seeing in the making. Now, one dramatic piece of fulfilled prophecy comes from the Russia-China alliance. All the way back in 1934, Herbert W. Armstrong described the way that you would see the rise of two great military powers. One would be the power we're watching rise in Europe, and the other, he said, would be Russia with her allies, possibly China or Japan. In 1959, his Plain Truth magazine continued to forecast that Russia and China would ally together. And at this point, the Soviet Union and Communist China were at loggerheads. And in fact, those two countries even went to war. Yet the Plain Truth continued to forecast that these two would be allied. That's a dramatic fulfilled prophecy. Those two are very close. But they prophesied another inclusion in this Asian alliance that has been less close until late, and that is India. But this week we got a good look at a growing bromance between India's President Narendra Modi and Russia's President Vladimir Putin. To hear more about that, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Shark.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. Right now, Russian President Vladimir Putin is on a two-day state visit to India. And some of the details that have emerged of this visit so far have been quite extraordinary. First, the Indian Prime Minister there, Mr. Narendra Modi, he apparently couldn't wait for Putin to meet him at the Panchavati in central New Delhi, as they had originally planned. Instead, Modi broke protocol by traveling to the Palam Airport in New Delhi so that he could personally receive Putin the moment he stepped off the plane. So that was quite unusual, but we have to keep in mind that this is Putin's first trip to India since he took the war on Ukraine full scale nearly 4 years ago. So Putin hadn't been there for all that time, and Modi really wanted to make this visit as special as possible. So at the airport, there was literal red carpet rolled out for Putin, and Modi greeted him on that carpet with one of his famous bear hugs and a hearty handshake. And then from there, the two men got in the same car for the trip to Modi's residence. And that's when this two-day visit began that is shaping up to be just quite a historic one. And I think that it is historic because during the first several years of Modi's leadership, he built a reputation of being able to very deftly balance India in between Russia and the United States. You know, both Russia and the United States wanted India to be closer to themselves, but Modi managed to sort of walk the tightrope and stay very well balanced in between them. But since Russia's war began, he has increasingly tilted it toward Russia and away from the United States. This has included key diplomatic and political support that Modi has given to Russia, and it includes major energy purchases and weapons purchases that have been instrumental in bankrolling Russia's war against Ukraine. And then more recently, we've had a situation where the Trump administration has imposed 50% tariffs on most Indian goods. This was supposed to drive a wedge between India and Russia, but instead the tariffs had just the opposite effect. They caused India and Russia to become even closer in the face of what the Indians perceived as unjustified antagonism, really, from the Americans. And then in the time since then, what had been kind of a cautious tilt by India toward Russia has shifted to active alignment. And right now, I think that Putin's visit there is further paralleling that alignment, just drawing India even closer to Russia and even further from the United States. And during this trip, they'll be discussing India's intention to obtain additional S-400 missile defense systems, and also even some of the S-500 systems, and a nuclear-powered Russian submarine that India plans to lease. They'll also be discussing a deal to begin joint production of Russia's Su-57 fighter jets in India. Then beyond the military realm, they'll be discussing a wide range of initiatives to shore up trade ties and energy cooperation, financial integration, people-to-people links as well. So really, with this trip, we are witnessing a dramatic deepening of Russia-India ties. And it has come as a bit of a surprise to some analysts, but on Trumpet World, we often discuss prophecies in the Book of Revelation about a 200 million man army that'll be coming together soon. You can see that in Revelation 9, verse 16. And the passage there shows that this massive Asian army will be one of the major belligerents in World War III. And there are several other biblical passages that give us more details about this future Asian force. One of the big ones that you can go to there is Ezekiel 38. Verses 1 and 2 show that this massive force will be led by Russia. But then verse 5 lists some ancient names for the peoples that primarily make up modern-day India, and says that they will also be a part of this Asian military bloc. So when we see Prime Minister Modi today breaking protocol to demonstrate his close personal relationship with Putin, and when we see them finding new ways to strengthen the already very robust ties between their nations and finding ways for India to be ever more autonomous from the United States, all of that is really setting the stage for India to take its part in this Russian-led Asian bloc. And since India's population is so vast, even bigger than China's now, we can see how that will, you know, really help this prophesied Asian bloc to achieve that number of 200 million soldiers, just an unprecedented size. So for anyone who would like to better understand these various prophecies, I would recommend ordering a copy of our free booklet. It's called Russia and China in Prophecy, and there's a whole chapter in there about India and India's place in this alliance. So it's just an excellent read if you'd like to really understand you know, the context of the current events that are happening today.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Jacques. Any other stories from Asia that caught your eye?
Just one other one that I wanted to mention, and that is that President Putin seems to be rejecting the latest peace proposal that's been put forth by the United States. This may seem like kind of a pointless charade in some ways. You know, why would Putin keep on making an appearance of seeking some sort of resolution to the war, and then, even when the terms of that resolution are extremely favorable to him, he ends up rejecting it, and he keeps on fighting? It may seem kind of pointless for this to be happening over and over again, but it's actually not at all. In the case of this latest iteration of the dance, before it was happening, the United States was discussing Tomahawks and discussing the possibility of giving Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine and allowing Ukraine to strike Russian energy infrastructure deep inside of Ukraine, deep inside of Russia. So, you know, the Trump administration thought that by helping Ukraine take out more of Russian energy, the economic pain would become just too great for Russia, and that it would eventually compel Putin to settle for some sort of negotiated peace. And I think that that was logical. And it was accurate, and it very well may have happened. But that's when we started to hear about more secret talks that had taken place between Russian officials and American officials. And then this new plan was floated and was discussed. And with those discussions, all talk of U.S. Tomahawks going to Ukraine ended. And we've not heard any sort of a resumption, you know, in those conversations about the Tomahawks. So that's extremely valuable to Vladimir Putin. It seems that he was able to use some real Sun Tzu strategy here, you know, some art of war kind of maneuvering. Destroying the Tomahawks without even firing a shot, destroying them with words, with subterfuge. And this is a pattern that we've seen several times since President Trump took office. You know, President Trump will grow weary with Putin's belligerence and with his pig-headedness, and President Trump will threaten some sort of punishment that could really, you know, could really tighten the screws on the Russians. But then a phone call will come from Moscow, or a meeting will be scheduled, and suddenly those threats from Trump are replaced with a different plan, and Putin will eventually reject that plan. And so the cycle goes. So I think it's very sad to see the Trump administration taken in by the same ploy over and over again as the soldiers keep on dying and as the civilians keep on dying in Ukraine. But here we are again, and it looks like there is not much cause for optimism, at least in the near term, regarding the efforts to end this horrendous war.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Perhaps the biggest news from Europe this week is some reporting from The Atlantic. We're seeing more and more Western news media wake up to the dramatic transformation that has been happening in Germany. We've got yet another headline from a major news magazine that could have come from the trumpet several years ago. Their headline is "The New German War Machine." That was published on Monday, and it is full of a warning. Well, it's by Isaac Stanley Becker. It's full of a warning about what is going on in Germany. He says, not long ago, these plans would have set off international alarms, referring to everything that Germany is doing in terms of turning around their military. It talks about the rise of AI, the massive use of the production of drones and of scientific startups going on there. He talks about the massive expansion in German military spending that we've covered in a lot of detail in this show. I found some of their writing. I mean, it's great to see and important to see a lot of these news magazines waking up to what is happening. At the same time, a lot of what's in there is material that we've already talked about that won't be new to you and most of our listeners. One of the bits, though, that I did find quite fascinating and I thought very well put was where it focused on how close Germany is drawn to Israel. It talks about the Arrow 3 weapons project and about how fundamental this is in Germany's defense, how much they're looking for this Arrow 3 missile system to defend Germany from missiles. It says, Arrow 3, the largest defense deal in Israeli history, reverses that logic of Germany protecting Israel by making Israel a guarantor of Germany's safety. Kruger, this German general, said that the work on the weapon system turned representatives from the two militaries into a family, and they built camaraderie while his staff waited out missile attacks in Tel Aviv's below-ground shelters with the Israeli counterparts. The weapons acquisition from Israel is one next step, Kruger said, in overcoming our history. And like we've talked about on this show, we have all of these prophecies that talk about a double cross. Hosea 5 and verse 13 is one of these, where Germany is going to look like a friend. Britain, Israel, in the Middle East, they will all be trusting Germany, find themselves betrayed. That's what this is building to. The article concluded with Stanley Becker saying, listening to plans for rearmament in the old Wehrmacht headquarters, I wondered whether Germans could get power right this time. He concluded, where were the good Germans, my great-grandfather asked. In jails and concentration camps, he answered, and buried in the earth. But as a refugee rescued here on the foot of the Statue of Liberty, he believed American influence would help secure peace and purge Europe of fascism. For a time it did. But that world is disappearing, and Germany's pacifism belongs to another age. You know, he finished by asking that question, where is this leading? And the Bible tells us. A lot of people have now relegated that history to history. Oh, World War II, yeah, we all know what happened then, but it's joked about, we've forgotten about it. It was 80 years ago, that was 2-3 generations on from that. And so people say, well, it doesn't really have any relevance to what's going on now. But the Bible says very differently. The Bible describes this power that is rising up in Europe, made up of 10 kings, that will be dominated by Germany. And Herbert W. Armstrong for years said, you're going to see Germany emerge at the head of Europe, first as a political union, then as a military union. And you're going to see them rise up as this great military power. And he even said Russia is the one that would do this. I mean, we can play a clip from him saying, or the fear of Russia would prompt Germany to do this. And here's a clip of him saying that.
Now, one of the great things that is urging Europe on, and perhaps the greatest thing that will cause them to hurry and get together on this, is their fear of what's going on in the Kremlin and the Soviet Union. And Andropov is frightening them. And that is going to rush them. They are losing confidence in the United States as having a military umbrella over them to protect them. And they want their own military force to protect themselves. That's the way they feel over there. Now, that is a chief incentive to unite them.
So when you see headlines like the new German war machine, that's fulfilled Bible prophecy. That's what God revealed through Herbert W. Armstrong being proven right and correct. Mr. Armstrong said they would rise up as a major military power. It has happened. Well, we should pay close attention to what he says will happen next. And if you want more on that and to hear what will happen next, Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry spoke about this on his Trumpet Daily Show this week. That was on Tuesday, that was on December 2nd, the title of the show, That Old Joke About German Militarization. He devoted pretty much the whole show to going through this important story. And you can find that show on Rumble and on YouTube. He also talked about the Pope's Peacemaker Tour. That's a daily show. You can get the latest news, you know, every day from that show. So I'd really encourage you to go and take a look at that. Some other stories from this week. Britain rolled out the red carpet for the German president. He and his wife arrived in Britain on December 3rd for the first state visit from a German president in 27 years. So today, Frank Steinmeier is just down the road from us, actually, the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier. He's in Coventry. He was, though, welcomed by King Charles at Windsor Castle. There was a state banquet, military parade. They had German flags flying around Windsor and London. He met with the prime minister. He's got a talk before Parliament. That's an honor they didn't give Donald Trump when he came recently, but they're giving that to the German president. And he's receiving an honorary degree from Oxford University. And this is coming after Britain and Germany signed their very first friendship treaty after World War II over the summer. We talk about that more in our article from the September Trumpet print edition, Aiding the Enemy. We can put a link to that in the show notes. But just like we said, with Israel in the Middle East and with the United States, as Germany rises as a major military power, Britain is now increasingly looking to Germany for their defense. And another power looking to Germany for their defense is Cyprus. Cyprus is taking over the rotating presidency of the European Council. And they've been consulting with Germany on that. One of the things that they've been doing is going on a massive military spending spree. This week, they announced they wanted to buy $1.4 billion worth of weapons under the EU's Security Action for Europe program. This is the program that's there to help them borrow a lot of money to spend on the military. Now, if you're used to things like US military spending, $1.4 billion might not really sound like very much. It didn't to me initially. But then I looked up that Cyprus's annual defense budget is only a little over half a billion dollars. So this is, you know, we're looking at kind of three times Cyprus's annual defense budget that they're wanting to spend in new weapons. So they're going on a massive shopping spree here. And a big part of their agenda for their presidency is to build up Cyprus as Europe's bridge to the Middle East. And I meant to plug it last week, but I forgot to do so. But if you go back on our archives on Trumpet World, if you didn't listen to Joshua Michels' show just over a week ago on our Wednesday show, it was a really fascinating program. He was interviewing a Cypriot expert who we've had on the show before, but Mr. Flurry has drawn a lot of attention to Cyprus's role in as Europe's bridge to the Middle East and as the We talked about the SAAM 83 alliance with Mihailo earlier. You know, Cyprus playing a key role as Europe gets more involved in the Middle East and moves troops into the Middle East. And they need a military presence in Cyprus. And that show really revealed how dramatically that is happening already. So if you haven't heard that, I'd encourage you to go back, track that down on YouTube, Rumble. Again, we could probably put a link to that in the show notes. For our final story, we'll go back to a question I feel like now we just come up to every few weeks on this show, but a question that gets more urgent each time that we ask it. And that is Donald Trump about to invade Venezuela? So to get the latest on this, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that is a very good question. My personal feeling is that we're definitely looking at regime change in Venezuela, probably in the near future. Whether that involves invasion or not, we'll see. But this is a story that's been getting a lot of press in the news for weeks, as Donald Trump has just deployed more ships and more military resources and more troops to the Caribbean Sea off the coast of Venezuela. They had some big escalations in the last few days with President Trump declaring a no-fly zone over Venezuela, not allowing Venezuelan planes to even in their own airspace. The Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, having ordered a drone strike on a drug boat in Venezuela, and then tweeting some memes about Franklin the Turtle that we've been sharing around the office this week, just highlighting his commitment to using military force to crack down on the drug war. Pope Leo weighing in this week in a very interesting way. Nicolas Maduro had sent a letter to the Pope asking him to intervene after Donald Trump started his military buildup. And on the plane back from Nicaea, Leo came in and said that he does not want a military invasion of Venezuela or any violence in Venezuela. That got a lot of press as the Pope rebuking Donald Trump, although I think that statement may have been misinterpreted somewhat, because immediately after he said he didn't want an invasion or violence in Venezuela, he then suggested that Trump use dialogue and economic pressure to bring about regime change in Venezuela, if that's what he wants to do. So an interesting statement. I've seen statements like this from popes before where they just condemn the violence and then maybe behind the scenes do some finagling to bring about regime change. But in this case, Pope Leo, he said he didn't want military invasion, but didn't stop there. He then went in and presented an alternative suggestion as to how to get Maduro out of office. And as I've brought up on this program before, just how the political situation in Venezuela is right now, if Maduro leaves office, any new regime, those negotiations are of necessity, going to have to incorporate the Venezuelan Bishops' Conference. Many of Nicolas Maduro's staunchest rivals are Catholic bishops in Venezuela. So I'm actually looking at this, the Pope's statement, basically as an endorsement, a tacit endorsement of Donald Trump's plan for regime change. He's just hoping it can be brought about through negotiation. And of course, those negotiations are happening in the first place because of Donald Trump's military buildup. So there may be a little bit of good cop, bad cop routine going on here where Donald Trump's saying, like, leave power or I'll invade, where the Pope's the one sitting down and be like, oh, I like you. I want to help you. I don't want Trump to invade you. Let's sit down and come up with a diplomatic solution to this, which might be working because we haven't had an official confirmation from this from the Trump administration. But according to the Telegraph, they're talking about leaked reports where both Trump and Marco Rubio actually made an offer to Maduro that if he leaves the country, if he willingly steps down and leaves the country, they won't go after him. And according to the Telegraph reports, Maduro's response to the offer is that he would be willing to go into exile in Russia or some other place as long as the Trump administration guarantees that he gets to keep $200 million of his personal wealth. So basically take a huge $200 million nest egg, head over to Russia, pal out with Ukrainian oligarch Viktor Yanukovych and Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad and these other group of deposed authoritarians that Putin seems to be gathering around him. So no word yet on what Trump's feelings were on him taking the $200 million. But I think between Pete Hegseth's threats to invade Venezuela or bomb Venezuela, the Pope's comments that he feels like negotiation is a better way than invasion to facilitate regime change, and then leaked report that Maduro himself has said he'd be willing to go into exile into Russia or elsewhere if the price is right. You've got all the parts in place for a regime change in Venezuela. And of course, as I've pointed out before, pointing back to comments that the late Herbert W. Armstrong and Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry have made, Bible prophecy does strongly indicate that there will be a strong Latin American-European alliance against the United States. The major languages in Latin America are Spanish and Portuguese, Spain and Portugal both being EU members. The major religion is Catholicism, which is the dominant religion in the European Union. And there are prophecies in Isaiah and Ezekiel about a mart of nations besieging the United States. I think the late Herbert W. Armstrong long expected that the Latin American nations would become vassals to Europe. And Trump editor-in-chief, in his article, Is America Being Besieged?, just talked about how logistically for the European Union to economically besiege the United States would require some Latin American involvement. And so for these reasons, regime change in Venezuela is prophetically likely. I'm not saying it's impossible that Nicolas Maduro, as anti-American as he is, wouldn't agree to help the European Union and other Latin American nations besiege the United States in the future. But just given just the high level of conflict Maduro has had with the Roman Catholic Church and his outreach to China and Russia and some of his antagonism against European Union leaders, getting a more pro-European, more pro-Catholic leader in Venezuela would definitely be a movement towards the ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy. And now we're actually seeing that it looks like there's a good chance that this year we could see a more European, more pro-Catholic leader in Venezuela. I wrote an article predicting the same thing when Hugo Chavez died, and then it just ended up getting another Chavez type in there. So that can was kicked down the road. But I do think there is a good chance of that. And it kind of ironically, because the interest of the president of the United States and the interest of the Roman Catholic Church seem to be aligned, at least in the short term, in this issue, it looks like both Trump and Pope Leo kind of have some agreement here in about bringing regime change. Pope Leo is definitely pushing for the negotiation. I think Donald Trump probably deep down wants to take the Steve Witkoff approach where dialogue solves everything. And I think he wants a negotiation as well. But realizing that like just asking for a negotiation with Venezuela has not worked well in the past, there needs to be at least the realistic threat of military force to convince Maduro to just try to stash up as much money as he can get in a negotiation and head over to Russia.
And this, I think, brings us a full circle, kind of back to where we began the show, talking about the way that Pope Leo has is doing a lot to build this alliance system for Europe. And he's talked about, as we mentioned at the start of the show, potentially visiting, traveling to the region in Latin America. So I mean, we've long forecast that relationship with the Catholic Church, and we've talked about this rising European power and that God is allowing, even enabling this power to rise to besiege and bring down the United States. If you're going to besiege the United States, you need Latin America and Venezuela and Cuba as well. And these are two key places that people have planned to besiege America from in the past. So a very important story there. Totally understandable why America would want to clear out a hostile regime that's bad for America and bad for its own people. But the Bible warns us to watch for Europe, led by the Catholic Church, moving into these locations if that does happen. Did you have any other stories from the English-speaking world to bring us, Andrew?
Yeah, several other stories. I'm sure in the near future we'll have much more to say about the Venezuela story. We'll have more developments. But in the short term, we've got a few other stories in the Anglo-American region. One story I wrote up for the Morning Brief this morning is the Supreme Court has issued a stay allowing the government of Texas to redraw their congressional districting maps to potentially give Texas five more Republican seats in the House of Representatives. This is something that a lower court had said Texas couldn't do because they were unfairly discriminating against racial minorities. The Supreme Court yesterday issued a stay saying that the lower court hasn't yet to provide any proof that discrimination against minorities was the motive behind Texas's decision. And until they can provide that proof, they don't have a right to tell Texas it can't redistrict its districts. And so basically issued a stay saying that Texas can proceed with its plans until further notice. So that's another development, just highlighting something our editor-in-chief has talked about from Amos 7 about a kingdom's court supporting an end-time Jeroboam, in this case, Donald Trump. And so we can expect to see more Supreme Court rulings favoring Donald Trump in the near future. We've also getting some more information about the Afghanistan evacuee who shot the two National Guard members the day before Thanksgiving. There's now getting more proof that he actually may have been blackmailed by the Taliban threatening to hurt his family unless he did this. And so if true, that's really just another highlighting of just what a disastrous decision it was for Joe Biden to let 190,000 Afghanis come to America after America's disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, is because, many of these evacuees were unvetted. It shows that this man, while he may have not have had a history of terrorism back in Afghanistan, definitely has family that the Taliban can use to pressure him into hurting Americans. President Trump, another big executive order, just highlighting what a puppet president Joe Biden was. He's basically declared all Joe Biden executive orders, executive actions, memoranda, etc., signed with the auto pen to be null and void. There's definitely a lot of questions about exactly how senile Joe Biden was, why he was using the auto pen so much, and whether he actually even had much awareness of the documents being signed in his name. That's what prompted Donald Trump to say anything he signed with the auto pen is null and void. Now, constitutionally, anything done by executive order can be undone by executive order. So President Trump has full legal right to overturn all of Joe Biden's executive actions, except maybe the pardons. The pardons are constitutionally protected, that the president pretty much has right to pardon anyone from any crime. So Donald Trump may have to provide additional proof that Joe Biden was unaware of who was being pardoned before he could make those pardons nullified. But the other executive orders, Donald Trump has full authority to just say that those are nullified now that there's a new president, because Joe Biden probably wasn't even aware of most of the things being signed under his name anyway. And then one last story that probably should be fairly obvious to those with some common sense, but we have a new study providing more proof that smartphones are indeed making your kids fat, tired, and miserable. Just the sheer amount of screen time is the blue lights disrupting sleep hormones, suppressing dopamine chemicals, and causing kids to eat more. And so just another proof of something we've written here on The Trumpet many times, that smartphones are addictive and bad for your health, and especially dangerous to children who don't actually know the risk of them. So if you're hoping to help your child sleep better, be more happy, and maybe lose some weight, taking away their smartphone is a scientific way to do that.
Well, that's a nice practical note to end the show on. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. And thank you very much to all of our panelists. Thank you to George Haddad, Jacob Hessong, and Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. Thank you to you, the listener, for joining us. If you have any questions or any comments, if you want to get in touch with us, feel free to email us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We would love to hear from you. We will be back next week. Until then, please keep watching your world.